From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, Raising Black Children, we talk with psychiatrist Alvin Poussin about how parents can help their children deal with racism and develop positive self-esteem. Poussin's book on the subject first came out almost 20 years ago. An updated version has just been reissued. Poussin was the consultant to The Cosby Show. Also, writer and pilot Lawrence Gonzalez tells us about the lure of flying and aeroacrobatics. His new book is called 10 Charlie. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg wonders about the origins of the concept of Superman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is considering having the federal government purchase vaccines against childhood diseases and provide the medicines free of charge. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
A White House spokesman said Monday that the president is looking hard at a plan to make sure all children are properly vaccinated. According to spokesman George Stephanopoulos, every dollar spent on immunization would save $10 in health care costs over the long term. The proposal is supported by pediatricians and child welfare groups, but it's opposed by the drug companies. Pharmaceutical manufacturers are concerned that if the government bought the entire supply of vaccines, it would control the price. The plan would cost up to $500 million a year above the $175 million the government already spends for vaccinations. According to government analysts, only 40% to 60% of preschool-age children get the vaccines they need for diseases like diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, and polio. In inner-city neighborhoods, that number can be as low as 10%. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher said that UN peacekeepers should be ready to take over the military operation in Somalia in the relatively near future. Christopher said that he and UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali have reached agreement that it was time the U.S. force was replaced by UN troops. Earlier, Boutros-Ghali had announced that 280 additional UN peacekeepers would be sent to Somalia to strengthen the UN's military headquarters. The Secretary General has said that he was reluctant for the UN to take over until the most dangerous areas in Somalia have been fully secured. About 200 Haitian refugees infected with the AIDS virus have begun a hunger strike. They're protesting their detention at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo, Cuba. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
The Haitians have refused food since Friday because they want their immigration status resolved. They were intercepted at sea by the Coast Guard and taken to Guantanamo for asylum interviews that haven't taken place yet. The U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service says the Haitians may have grounds to file asylum claims in the U.S., but they're barred from entering the country because of the AIDS virus. Meanwhile, attorneys for the Haitians have sued the federal government for the right to represent them in asylum hearings at Guantanamo. Haitians were brought to the base following the overthrow of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in September 1991. Some were allowed in the U.S., but most were returned to Haiti. Only those with the AIDS virus now remain at the base. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
Stock prices posted a sharp increase today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 22 points to close at 3,322. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 2-to-1 in heavy trading of 238 million shares. This is NPR. The European Community foreign ministers decided today not to impose tougher sanctions against Serbia in retaliation for its support of Serbian rebels in Bosnia. Instead, the EC ministers endorsed a peace plan that would divide Bosnia-Herzegovina into 10 semi-autonomous provinces and urged the warring parties to adopt it. The Cambodian government is conducting a big military offensive against the Khmer Rouge around the town of Pai Linh in the northeast of the country. The administration in the capital, Phnom Penh, says its troops are trying to retake villages lost to the Khmer Rouge. Sue Downey filed this report for the BBC.
This is the most serious ceasefire violation since the UN Transitional Authority, UNTAC, began its operation in Cambodia in March last year. In the past 4 days, UN officials have reported mortar and artillery shelling and major troop and ammunition movements in 9 districts. Phnom Penh's General Pan Thai denies his army has launched an offensive. He says the Phnom Penh forces are responding in self-defence to attacks initiated by the Khmer Rouge. But the UN spokesman, Eric Berman, says this appears to be a planned offensive by the Phnom Penh forces against the much smaller Khmer Rouge army, with the guerrillas responding. The UN says it's also received reports that the government is conscripting young men into its army, in some cases using refugees who recently returned from camps in Thailand.
Sue Downey reporting. The Clinton administration has extended a deadline for the European community to end alleged discrimination against American goods. The policy in question is an EC directive that says member nations must give preference to other member nations when they make government purchases of goods like transportation equipment. U.S. Trade Representative Mielke Kantor said today that the U.S. will retaliate if the EC doesn't scrap that policy by March 22nd. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. For more than 10 years, my guest, Dr. Alvin Poussant, was the psychiatrist for the Huxtables, the fictional family on The Cosby Show. Poussant is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School, and he was the script consultant for Cosby's show. Poussant also writes about black family issues for Ebony magazine. The gurus of child-rearing, Drs. Spock and T. Barry Brazelton, have little expertise in race-related issues. So in 1975, Dr. Poussant joined with Dr. James Comer of the Yale Child Studies Center to write the book Raising Black Children. An updated edition has just been published. Dr. Poussant himself is the father of a 13-year-old son. Though Poussant believes that the basics of child-rearing are universal, there are some needs specific to black children.
I think the unique needs of black children come from a number of sources. First, the parents have to have a positive attitude. What I mean by that, let's say that there are black parents who themselves lack in self-esteem because they're black, or feel negative about themselves because of that. That, well, they have to work on themselves, because if they don't, when their child is born, they may transmit some of this negative feeling about being black to their children in a variety of kinds of ways, including how they receive them into the world, what they feel their life chances may be, how they react to their skin color. So that first there's a job for parents. After that, I think it's very important, as the children are growing up and developing, for instance, when you start to talk to them and read to them and tell them stories, that you not just use the traditional materials like Goldilocks and Little Red Riding Hood and Jack and Jill and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty and on, because in all of those tales, fairy tales and Mother Goose rhymes, all of the characters are white. And after a while, the child is going to wonder, where do they fit in? Where do they belong?
Would you say that the traditional psychiatry, traditional psychology has been culturally biased, has been unaware of the unique and special needs of black children?
Well, I think that often, despite the prejudice and discrimination in the country and the unique problems of a lot of minorities, frequently psychiatry and the other fields have tried to be colorblind, which you can't be. And frequently when they say colorblind, they don't really mean colorblind. They mean using the traditional kinds of approaches with everyone. And those traditional approaches are primarily kind of America-European and white.
And so what is missing, you think?
Well, first of all, I think what's missing is, I think, people in the mental health field, people working with children, school teachers, need much more educational background and cross-cultural issues and cultural differences between people so that they can more effectively work with them and understand their special issues and problems. In addition, I think that workers in these fields have to have some grasp and understanding of racism and its effect on families and children.
Well, how did you raise your children to cope with the discrimination that they might face?
Well, I think in a variety of ways. I think one, in the kinds of materials I read to my child, I made sure that he had a multicultural library, and sometimes I made up stories myself to tell my my son in particular, about how I had grown up, my neighborhood I grew up in. I've worked, spent a lot of time working in the civil rights movement since the 60s. And I've talked to him, and even when he was little, went to his school and gave talks on Martin Luther King Day about what it was like in the South back in the 60s and what was done to black people and the struggles that went on. So he was exposed very early to those kinds of historical realities. And he's still able to ask questions and to wonder and even ask questions about the past. So I think a lot of black parents, in fact, have to do that with the children, is to tell them something about the past, not to make them feel badly about it, but to give them strength. For instance, there are some black parents who feel embarrassed to talk to their children about the fact that we were once slaves, because they feel it's stigmatizing and they feel uncomfortable talking about it. Well, I think that you have to talk about those things, but you have to talk about it from a position of strength. That yes, this was a wrong, but through our strength and perseverance, etc., we've survived. We're doing much better. There's still a struggle going on, and all of you, your new generation, has to take part in continuing those efforts so that that discrimination and as much of racism as possible is eliminated.
Were you careful about transmitting the rage you might have felt about racism?
Yes, I'm careful about that, because I don't think it's productive to have children act out your rage or feel it constantly. I'm not feeling it constantly, so that's no problem. But I let him know that it's appropriate to feel angry when people mistreat you. But I wouldn't want him to go on some kind of destructive rage bent, which some children do, teenagers do, striking out and feeling hopeless. I try to give him a balanced sense of you. There's a lot you can do, but you may face some problems, but you can deal with them effectively, but you have to recognize them and be ready to.
What happens when race is not a topic of conversation in black families? And in your book, you say that most African-American parents don't really talk to their children about race.
Well, I think some do and some don't. Actually, they pick it up, because if the black parents who say they're not talking to the children about race are frequently talking to each other about race rather frequently, because of what's happening in the world. If they're not talking about South Africa, they're talking about the Rodney King beating. They're talking about other incidents all around the country. They're talking about the campus racial incidents. So they're talking about it all the time, and children are in the home, and children pick up on it. Now, the sad thing is if they pick up on the adult conversations and they have questions, those parents who avoid trying to help them to understand what they're talking about, I think black parents should assume that children know what's going on in a home and what's being discussed. They pick up on it, and that they should be included at the level of their understanding without frightening them to understand some of these things.
There's a section in the book where a parent has a concern. They have a 4-year-old black child who calls himself white. When do young children begin to feel their race or begin to be very conscious of what race they are?
Well, they begin to pick up on these things. It's going to vary a little bit. Let's say in an average age around 4 or 5, they begin to pick up and recognize differences, more and more boys and girls, and that hair is a different color and skin color, etc. And they will react to it in various ways. A black child who says at age 4, I want to be white, may really not be saying what he thinks he's saying. That it may not really mean that he's rejecting being black. What it may mean, for instance, if he's in an environment where all the other kids are white, is kind of saying, well, why aren't I should be like my friends or the other kids that I play with? their concept of race isn't that well developed, and that's why parents, you know, have to step in there and begin to educate them about the world, that people come in different colors, and some brown people and Asian people and so on, and that the color of the skin, you know, doesn't matter that much, that everybody, you know, the parents have to step in and give them some direction. Now, if that same child was being made fun of or in some way attacked because their skin was brown and then came home and said, hey, Mom and Dad, I want to be white, that would be a different order of business, see. Then you would have to intervene in another way, really reassure that child that he's fine. If necessary, talk to the parents or the school if that type of thing is going on, and make sure the problem's corrected.
What responsibility do you think interracial couples have for their children in terms of talking about race, or we'll say white couples who adopt black babies? And does that complicate the race issue?
Well, I think it complicates the race issue somewhat, but it's not insurmountable. The reason why I say complicated, it really depends on the parents. Now, I've seen interracial couples, for instance, where for some one reason or the other, they want to totally deny the importance of race, or race is a factor. And, you know, their child is biracial, and that's fine, but they're going to raise the child to be colorblind. Well, that's nice and idealistic, but it's not reality, because that child, whether they like it or not, may come back from school and meet up with all of the kinds of incidents that the so-called regular black child would have to face, because the society would be reacting to this child, even if it was he was more light-skinned and so on, as a black child. So they're likely to be called racial slurs, too, if that comes up. They're likely to have concerns about, well, I want to be all white or whatever, I want to be black. They bring up similar issues. So I think that interracial couples have to be prepared to deal with the realities of race issues in the United States.
My guest is Dr. Alvin Poussant, and he's a child psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and the co-author of a book which was written back in 1975 and has been...
Yeah, co-author, by the way, with Dr. James P. Comer, who's a child psychiatrist at the Yale Child Center in New Haven.
That's right, and the book is called Raising Black Children. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Alvin Poussant, and we're talking about a book that he co-authored with Dr. James Comer called Raising Black Children. Do black children and black adults feel that everything they do reflects on their race? Is that a given?
You can get in that mentality. That's often been a burden, and sometimes can become an overwhelming burden. That is where the black person is constantly feeling, hey, everything I do, I'm not just doing it myself as an individual. It means that whatever I do, people will use to judge the entire race of black people. Well, that's a burden, and in fact, when white people do that, that's racism too, that they put such a burden on an individual black person, and a kind of saying, if you mess up, we're going to take it to mean that all black people are incompetent. So you better make sure you do a good job. Well, that's no one else has that burden. I mean, a white person can mess up and fail, and no one starts thinking, well, that means all white people are inferior. But unfortunately, in the way racism operates, that sometimes a black person can fail in a job, and they generalize from it, white people, and say, well, black people just don't have ability in this, or black people just can't do this or that. And you even still today hear weird remarks like, well, we tried a black in that position once and it didn't work out, so we won't hire another one because that one black. Well, that is really primitive thinking, if I can use that word, and very bigoted thinking.
Well, I would think that puts a parent in really a no-win situation.
The parent in a no-win situation?
Yeah, because you're dealing with the reality, which is that the white world is making judgments about an individual black person and what it says about their race, and yet you're saying, which of course is understandable, that the pressure on a parent or on a child to be an ambassador for their race is an impossible one.
Yeah, I think it's an impossible one, and I don't think that most people should take that on. Except to some extent. You see, it depends. I think that we want black children to be proud and feel good about being black, African American. At the same time, we feel that enormous pressure that may come where a child feels that everything they do means they're representing the race can be so intimidated that it actually interferes with their success. For instance, I'll give you a specific example.
Go ahead.
I come across black children, and even on college campuses, black students, who are afraid to talk in class because they feel so much pressure that if they don't look bright, if they give the wrong answer, that it's going to reflect negatively on black people in general. So it inhibits them from participation and doing the kinds of things that students do, that is, making mistakes, sometimes giving the wrong answer, which is all part of being a student and developing. That black students have to feel free, to some extent, to make mistakes and to fail without feeling that somehow they're destroying or hurting the entire community. The burden of that problem should be with white people, that white people have to stop doing that. And they have to understand that black people are not representing their race, that they are individuals. They come from a particular ethnic group. I remember back in the old days growing up, every time Joe Louis and other black athletes won some championship, the announcers would be on the radio and say, "Hey, you know, Joe Louis, you're a real credit to your race."
Huh.
Now, that's like weird. I mean, in fact, I don't know of another group where they use that term. I've never heard them say to a white person, "Hey, you know, you're a credit to your race because you flew to the moon or something." Maybe they're thinking that. Who knows? But I don't hear them say that even to a lot of other ethnic groups. So the implication in "you're a credit to your race" is that, you know, the race ain't so hot, you know, so you your accomplishment means that you're special, and maybe will help change the attitudes we all have that black people are inferior. See, those are the kinds of subtleties that we have to alert our children to.
Are the kinds of subtleties that you're describing, does that really then describe the difficulty of raising a black child in the 90s, which is that racism can look much more disguised?
Yes, it can be more disguised. It's not as overt, but it may be there. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell. Let me tell you, for instance, sometimes racism may appear because a particular white person doesn't make eye contact with black people, but makes eye contact with white people. On the other hand, let's say there's a white person that has to interview a black person. And that white person, in fact, in general, doesn't make eye contact with anyone. The black person in that situation may feel very awkward and wondering, well, is this person not making eye contact with me and kind of avoiding my gaze and so on because they're uncomfortable because I'm black? Or is this white person someone who is like this all the time? Well, frequently, there's no way to find out. So that black person may leave that interview very troubled, feeling, well, that person really didn't want to relate to me, really didn't want to talk to me, really didn't want me in the office, was very uncomfortable with me. And they begin to feel, well, maybe it probably was because I was black, but they're not sure. So those kinds of incidents occur constantly, leaving a lot of black people in positions of feeling, very ambivalent and stressed frequently. You go into the market or grocery store or department store, and you meet a clerk that's very nasty to you. And you stop and wonder, well, is the clerk being nasty to me because I'm black, or is this just a nasty clerk? But you may leave that store still with the question. And that's stressful and sometimes very difficult to resolve, because it could be either. But it's hard for the black person with just one incident, unless they're going to stand around all day and watch the store clerk to see how she behaves to other people, to know if they're being mistreated because of their skin color.
You were a consultant to the Cosby Show. How do you think that show changed understanding of black families?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to measure. I mean, you know, I want to hope or say that the show had a very positive impact on white Americans and black Americans as well. It was a widely watched show for 8 years, one of the most successful TV shows in television history. And it depicted a black family that was upper middle class, but a family that most families across class lines and across ethnic lines could identify with. You know, dealing with the day-to-day kinds of problems families have with children. But it was a professional family, so that there were, you saw, it was hard to stereotype black people when you looked at the Cosby Show, because the children were all very different, of different types. The parents were a professional couple, and I think that was important, because before then you didn't see blacks playing those kinds of roles, doctors and lawyers. So that hopefully it gave children kind of a sense of what they could be and where they could go. The show constantly emphasized education, and I think it taught white people and other people that the issues in the black community and black family are very similar to the issues that they deal with, that we have much more in common in terms of the day-to-day struggles that we have with other groups than we have differences. And that's why I think the Cosby Show was able to be adapted and put on television in over 30 countries all around the world, dubbed in various languages.
What actually did you do there, and how did you work with the scriptwriters and the stars?
Well, what I did, Cosby hired me for the show, and he wanted me to critique the scripts. He wanted me to read through the scripts and to help him to do certain things, to be an alter ego for him. One, he wanted very much for the show not to use put down or insult humor or derogatory humor. So I was on the alert for that. He also wanted the show to be psychologically believable in its interactions with the children and the family and the dynamics, so that it would seem as real as possible, given the limitations of the sitcom, so that it would seem like real life, even though it was humorous, so that people could identify with the show, that the show shouldn't be a bunch of one-liners with no plot. Then he wanted me to help suggest different ways in which the show could be educational, and then also when any opportunity that I had to help put the show in a black cultural context.
Dr. Alvin Poussin is a child psychiatrist and co-author of Raising Black Children. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Writer Lawrence Gonzalez was raised on stories of flying, like other kids are raised on fairy tales. His father was a bomber pilot in World War II. So it's no wonder that Gonzalez himself is a pilot and that he writes about flying in mythic terms. Coming up, a talk with Lawrence Gonzalez about the lure of flight. Also, now that the comic book hero Superman is dead, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg looks at his origins. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton met today with the nation's governors, and he moved to ease federal constraints on how states administer Medicaid. Mr. Clinton said this was one step toward cutting spiraling health care expenses. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
States have been demanding more flexibility in how they run their Medicaid programs for years. Today, President Clinton, a former governor, ordered the Health and Human Services Department to streamline the process by which states seek Medicaid waivers.
The states very often believe that they can provide more services at lower cost if we don't impose our rules and regulations on them.
As expected by the Clinton administration, the action was applauded by both Democrat and Republican governors who met for more than 2 hours with the president at the White House. They say easing waivers will cut the red tape associated with Medicaid and will also provide the flexibility states need to try alternative ways of delivering health care. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that he's quite optimistic about solving a controversy involving 400 Palestinians expelled by Israel last month. After exchanges involving Christopher and Israeli Prime Minister Rabin, Israeli television reported today that 100 of the Palestinians would soon be released, and the rest will be returned within a year. Christopher had a luncheon meeting today in New York City with UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. And afterwards said that over the last several days, the U.S. and Israel have been engaged in very broad consultations on the issue that should allow them to put the controversy behind them. Iraq's U.N. ambassador says that he has seen signals from Washington that indicate to him that President Clinton might be more open to talks with Baghdad. Tension has eased in the Persian Gulf area since Iraqi gunners stopped challenging Western planes patrolling Iraq's no-fly zones. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia.
Iraq's official media quoted Nizar Hamdoun saying there are signals from the new U.S. administration that contained what he called some objectivity. He didn't say what the signals were, but said they suggested the U.S. was turning to dialogue to avoid war. Hamdoun cautioned, though, that it was too early to say that a change was in the offing. They were Hamdoun's first public remarks since returning from New York for consultations in Baghdad, following Iraq's so-called goodwill ceasefire 2 weeks ago. Iraq hopes to mend relations with the U.S. and U.N., mainly with a view to getting sanctions lifted. It was apparently with this in mind that Hamdoun was dispatched to New York last year. He has a reputation as a skillful diplomat who once served as Iraq's ambassador to Washington when the two countries enjoyed much better relations. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 22 points. This is NPR News. Republican Senator John Danforth has announced that he will not run for re-election next year. Danforth, an Episcopal priest, says he wants to continue a commitment that he has made to the church and also practice law. The former Missouri State Attorney General said that he and his family will return to St. Louis next year. Danforth was first elected to the Senate in 1976, and some were surprised that he ran for a third term, having said in the past that two terms were enough for a senator. A federal grand jury has indicted former New York Chief Judge Saul Wachler on charges that he tried to extort money from a woman with whom he had been involved. The indictments were handed down today in Newark. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Wachler was charged with making a false statement to a federal agency, mailing threatening letters, and crossing state lines to promote extortion. Wachler was the state's highest-ranking judge until last November, when he was accused of trying to extort $20,000 from Republican fundraiser Joy Silverman. Authorities said he had sent letters to Silverman threatening her and her daughter. Officials said today that before his arrest, Wachler sent an anonymous letter to police falsely stating that Arthur and Irene Seal were behind the threats to Silverman. They are the New Jersey couple arrested for the kidnapping and murder of Exxon executive Sidney Riso last year. They have no known tie to Wachler. Wachler faces up to 16 years in prison and over $1 million in fines. Reuters quoted his attorney as saying he would plead not guilty because of mental illness. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The government says while construction spending was unchanged in the month of December, for the whole of last year it increased 6.2%. Most of the increase came in construction of single-family homes. The Commerce Department revised figures down for October and November. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There are hundreds of small airfields that dot the countryside all across America. Many have been carved out of farmland and are hangouts for pilots and high-flying adventurers. These small mom-and-pop operations are in danger of becoming obsolete, pushed out by sprawling commercial airports, suburban development, and the high cost of owning and maintaining a small private plane. Writer and flyer Lawrence Gonzalez wanted to capture that life before it was gone. His new book, 10 Charlie, is about one small airstrip in northern Illinois. It's also about the eccentric characters and adventurers who are drawn to flying, as well as his own attraction to the dangers and his passion for the thrill. I asked Gonzalez to read an excerpt from the book about the impulse to fly.
I do not mean to say that anyone who learns to fly an airplane is an addict. For many people, it is merely a pastime or a profession, and an airplane is simply a tool, like a halberd or a hypodermic needle. But there are those of us who fly, I mean who really fly a lot and with a mad, insatiable passion and all the time thinking and dreaming of it, with that tingling in our fingers and toes, yearning for the feel of the stick and rudder, and with a deep socket in our bellies that can only be filled by G-force and swirling mists. And I believe that we perform our feats of daring in the service of altered brain chemistry. It is precisely this impulse that has been the cornerstone of aviation since the very beginning. Why else would someone throw himself off a cliff with a pair of homemade wings strapped to his back while the certainty of death and the hope of flight struggle for dominion over his leaping heart? The impulse, a mystical disease of the mind which overwhelms our will and propels us against all good sense not simply into flight, but into more and more dangerous and audacious methods of rocketeering, controlled falling, death leaps, and fiery plummets to earth. The impulse. It's the only explanation.
Did you feel that impulse the first time you flew?
Absolutely. I did. It was, and many, many people have described the same thing to me. The old man who started the airfield about which this book is written, Art Gault, who is now, I think, 82, He went out there to be a farmer, and one day he happened to get a ride in an airplane, and it was all over for him. It was the end. He had to go and learn to fly, and in fact, his whole life became aviation, and he now owns an airport. And it happens that way over and over again. Some people are immune to it, but for some people, it simply takes over in a way that is like nothing else except an addiction.
Well, you describe it as an experience of altered brain chemistry, almost as if it's a fever.
I think so. There's a section in this book in which we describe the aerobatic pilots I fly with. We go up and we do things that look like dangerous things to other people, but we consider that it's safe enough if we follow the rules. And one of the rules is you don't roll the airplane on takeoff. It's too low. It's too dangerous. So there's always somebody saying, now remember, no low-level aerobatics. Don't roll on takeoff. And the next thing you know, you turn around and a guy's doing it. He's like rolling the airplane on takeoff. And you say, why did you do that? And he can't explain. It's like, I don't know. I was just taking off and it just felt right. And I thought, God, you know, this is great. I'm going to roll. And, well, people get killed doing that all the time. Why do we do that?
But is there something about bending the laws of nature, bending the rules, that somehow when you get close to that, you think, well, I'll just take one more little step?
Well, I think there is, but I think there is also literally a kind of it's like a downhill skier needs to go down the slope. What does he get out of the slope? He doesn't go anywhere. When he's at the end, he's just at the bottom where he started. What's in between? I think what's in between is a great mystery, and most people who are interesting are following some sort of mystery in their lives. And for those of us who are captured by flying, we go up, the world drops away, and there's this kind of celestial spider out there weaving this web that we're caught in, and that is our mystery. We're going toward it all the time. We never get there. We never find out what it is.
What is it, though, about flying that makes people so philosophical? And I would say almost everyone I've interviewed about flying and being a pilot, they always have these philosophical thoughts.
Yes. Well, think about it. I mean, let's suppose that you're an adventurer and you decide you're going to go into the Congo and experience this amazing wilderness that no other human being has ever been in. And you go out there and you stay for a year and you come back and you've had a lot of time to get in touch with yourself and think about things and sort of pursue the inner course of your spirit and life. And what we have that like in our backyards. We drive to the airport 15 minutes away, jump in the plane, the earth drops away, and we're in this alien environment where we can meet ourselves. No one up there can bring us back. It's all our own skill. We're completely dependent on ourselves. We might as well be in the deepest, darkest jungle because nothing's going to bring us back except our own ability. And out there, all alone like that, with all of the stuff of the earth having fallen away from us, we're not thinking about our MasterCard bill. We're not thinking about Clinton's proposals. We're just out there completely alone with the sky. And it's not even a sky we recognize because we're in the middle of it. So it's all of this faint, misty stuff. And of course, we're going to start thinking about spiritual and philosophical things up there.
When you're flying, are you consciously aware of death?
Well, not every moment. I mean, you do get used to flying, and it can be dangerous in some ways to become complacent. But yes, there are always things happening around you that make you used to it. I mean, the smell of gasoline will really, really get your attention in an airplane because you will know someone who has been incinerated. Or if you see an airplane go by close to you, it'll get your attention because you know someone who's died in a mid-air collision. Because of the fact that many of your friends have already died, it's in the back of your mind, if not in the front of your mind.
Well, I want to talk about aerial acrobatics, which you got into, but first I want to take a very short break. My guest today is Lawrence Gonzalez, and we're talking about a book he's just written called 10 Charlie, Adventures in Grassroots Aviation. It's about the world of amateur aviation, and my guest is both a writer and a pilot. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Lawrence Gonzalez, and he's written a book called 10 Charlie. That's the name for a private airfield, which is located in northern Illinois. It's a Galt Airport. Now, let's talk about your foray into aerial acrobatics. What made you think that you were going to take then the next step? Why wasn't just flying enough for you?
Well, it's interesting because when I first flew, I was so scared that I thought just getting from one airport to another and landing safely was a great accomplishment, and I would want to rush back and tell all my friends about it. But I went out. My father was receiving this decoration at Randolph Air Force Base for Air Force flying he had done, and I was out there with all these jets screaming around overhead, and I just had to get up in one, and I finally managed to get a ride, and this fellow let me do loops and rolls and all these other things, and I just realized how tremendously important it was that I get an aerobatic airplane and learn to do that myself.
Now, what's the first thing that you learn?
Well,
where do you start?
It depends on who your instructor is, but my aerobatics instructor, John Morrissey, believes that to teach the roll is the correct way to begin teaching aerobatics because it's probably the hardest thing to do. It looks very simple.
And the roll is, just describe for us.
The roll is one wing goes down, the other wing goes up, and you just keep going around until you're back right side up. It is the basis of so many other maneuvers that the feeling is that if you can learn to do that right, you have a firm foundation. It's like learning scales in music before you learn to play arias.
And how was it for you to do your first roll then?
Well, it was horrible. First of all, you find that as soon as you tip the airplane over, it starts to fall out of the sky, so you have to correct for that. And when you get to about the knife edge where your wing is pointing straight down at the ground, why, everything goes completely haywire. And as you go upside down, the controls seem to reverse, so you put the stick one way and it wants to go the other way. It's just totally confusing. And you have to sort of get in your mind a picture of where all these little pieces of the airplane are pointing into the airstream. And, of course, while you're doing this, your head is banging against the side of the canopy and you're being pulled and you're hanging by your seatbelt when you're upside down, and it's all disconcerting. The blue part that we call the sky is now on the bottom and the green part is on the top. It's just a total mess.
I've noticed in looking through some of the other things that you've written that you do seem to have an interest in danger. You've done essays on, or you did an essay on the death chamber and prisoners put to death and jails and things like that.
I would say the death chamber has a very high mortality rate.
It's a very
dangerous place to be statistically. I have a new book that I've been working on for several years that's it's not out yet. It's a collection of essays about people who have dangerous professions. And I've worked as a fireman, and I've worked on top of tall construction sites and out on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico, which was probably the scariest place I've ever been.
What made working on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico so difficult?
Well, it's kind of like being in a Cuisinart when the blades start turning. The oil rig is this platform that stands about 16 stories out of the sea, and on top of it, there's this naked skeleton of steel, and there are all these moving parts. They're constantly in motion all over the deck. And so it's kind of like being in some machine that's designed to slice things up, and you're one of the things, and you just have to get out of the way. And not only that, but the fellows that I was working with there, these were not like the firemen who I think would have saved my life if anything bad had happened to me. These were guys who were looking at me like, it might be fun to see a reporter get crushed.
Well, did they try to put you in harm's way just to teach you a lesson?
There was one moment that I describe in this essay where I was standing there watching a guy put together a piece of drilling equipment, and I all of a sudden noticed that about five people were looking at me, and they were kind of like looking just a little past me. And I thought, what are they looking at? I'm just standing here taking notes. And I turned around just in time to see this beam. It was about 30 feet long, and it was being moved by a crane, and it was coming right for me. And I just kind of stepped aside, and it went by, and they all kind of shrugged. Well, I guess it missed him this time.
But you don't think they would have told you at the last minute?
It didn't look like it for me. A lot of them also, it was an interesting crew. It was kind of like being on a pirate ship. Some of these guys had missing fingers and missing hands and missing eyes. And, you know, they all had a story to tell. So
are there, do you enjoy the mundane things of life as well?
Of course. Well, but what's mundane in life? Nothing
well, I don't
is
know.
Mundane.
I don't know. I mean,
what could be mundane? All I thought when I went out to do this book about Galt Airport is a very quiet, sleepy little place, you know. And I thought, this will be a nice, relaxing place to be for a while. I think I'll just stay here and sort of, you know, with these quiet little people around me and find out what their lives are like. I had no idea it was going to turn into this amazing adventure.
Well, can you say the same thing for the work that you did in Hollywood? And you once wrote for TV shows, one called Codename Foxfire.
Right.
Did you have that same experience out there?
Well, I went out to work for Universal and then for Warner Brothers in serial television. You know, whatever you see when you turn on the TV at 7 o'clock, that's the kind of stuff we were doing, and which I thought was really, really awful. But the people who did it were so fascinating. They were just not to be believed. And they were so outrageous that I used to sit in these meetings and just take down what they said because I thought, nobody's going to believe this guy said this.
Well, what's an example of an unbelievable interchange?
Well, geez. I mean, they used to talk about, well, I can't even repeat it on the radio. They used to talk about the star, Kate Jackson, who was the star of this one show we worked on called Scarecrow and Mrs. King, in ways that were just unrepeatable. And all day long. I mean, she was supposed to be this, like, idol that the audience loved her. But the people who wrote her lines just despised her, and for good reason, because she would take the scripts and send them back at 11 o'clock at night and demand that they be rewritten. There was one scene where there was a duck in a pond in this scene, and she demanded that the duck be removed because she hated ducks. So we all had to stay up till midnight writing this duck out of the script.
Well, I thank you very much. It's really been fun to talk with you, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lawrence Gonzalez is a flyer and a writer. His book is called 10 Charlie. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Noah. What do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. Healthcare is coming up this week at the White House, and we'll have a talk with New Jersey Governor Jim Florio. He wants the states to be sure and have time to figure out their own improvements. Tom Jelton in Sarajevo talks with Alija Izetbegović, the president of Bosnia, about the Vance-Owen peace plan now before the United Nations. I'll talk with Carol Williams of the Los Angeles Times from Zagreb about claims made in Croatia by the president, Franjo Tuđman, to retake all the land lost to Serb fighters in the territory that's now been under United Nations protection. Also, a short, sleek subway in Los Angeles.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been a couple of months since Superman was killed off in one of the last issues of Superman comics. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says Superman may have been the victim of his own name.
Of course, Superman isn't likely to stay dead. It's a safe bet he'll be brought back with a new secret identity and a new costume. He should definitely lose the cape, which evokes a troubling resemblance to late-period Elvis, another personality of uncertain vital signs. And the last sentence of the comic book suggested he may have a new name, too. For this was the day that a Superman died. A Superman. I had the sense they were trying to give the name back to the language as a common noun. Only it's a little late for that. The word began with Nietzsche, who used the German word Übermensch to describe a person who had shaken free of the cloying resentments of Christian morality. Some philosophers have translated this as overman or beyond man. But Superman wasn't a bad choice when George Bernard Shaw introduced the word in the title of his 1903 play, Man and Superman. At that time, the prefix super was chiefly used to mean over or beyond in learned words like superabundant, superstructure, and supernatural. But the word Superman has had a bumpy ride from there on in, and it's taken the prefix along with it. One of the villains of the piece was Nietzsche's younger sister, Elizabeth, whose strange story is recounted in a fascinating new book by Ben McIntyre called Forgotten Fatherland. Elizabeth was her brother's match in dementia, if not in genius. She married an unbalanced character named Bernard Förster, who was a disciple of Wagner and a rabid anti-Semite. In 1886, the two of them led a band of settlers to the jungles of Paraguay to found a colony called New Germany. Here they hoped that an Aryan utopia would flourish in isolation from the influences of decadence and cosmopolitanism, which was to say, the Jews. When the colony failed a few years later, Förster committed suicide, and Elizabeth returned to Germany. After her brother went mad in 1891, she devoted herself to looking after him and nurturing the cult that had begun to grow up around his work. By judicious editing and sometimes by outright forgery, she recast him as the prophet of German nationalism and racialism. She was an early supporter of the Nazis, who were eager to see Nietzsche's Superman as the philosophical progenitor of their master race. Nietzsche would not have been pleased by any of this. He disliked nationalism of all sorts and regarded anti-Semitism as a sign of feeble character. But the Superman was tarred with a Nazi brush, and when the comic book hero was introduced in 1938, it was as an American response to the Nazi type. Like the Nazi version, our Superman was an exceptional biological specimen, an uncritical patriot, and something of a moral simpleton. The resemblance didn't escape American leftist critics of the period, who even perceived an ominous connection between the S on Superman's chest and the SS tattooed on the arms of Hitler's stormtroopers. Of course, there were differences. Our Superman had curly blue-black hair that suggested a Mediterranean or Semitic appearance. And there was a nice twist in the story of his origin that was given several years later, where it was explained that he had acquired his magic powers when he escaped his doomed home planet to come to a new world under a yellow sun. It was a fable of immigrant success that Elizabeth Nietzsche would have envied. The end of World War II left the Nazi concept of the Superman pretty much discredited, with a man of steel in sole possession of the field. And the popularity of the character led in turn to new uses of the prefix super to refer to anything that was grander or bigger than its predecessors. We got superstars, super savers, super bowls, and Super Tuesday, not to mention supermarket and the strangely contradictory superette. From there, it was only a matter of time until the prefix detached itself and set up a life of its own as an adjective of insincere and gushing approval. Oh, that was just super. But superlatives like these have short half-lives. If the NFL had it to do over again, you can be sure they would have called it the Ultra Bowl, the Mega Bowl, or maybe the Intense Bowl. In the course of things, the comic book hero came to seem, well, comic, and not even the industrious irony of three Richard Lester movies could redeem him. I'm sure Nietzsche would be relieved. Superman is dead, and with any luck, the Super Bowl is next.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's program was produced by Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moscowane.
More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman. Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Republicans lost the middle class. We talk with commentator and analyst Kevin Phillips. He has a new book about the forgotten middle class. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. For more than 10 years, my guest, Dr. Alvin Poussant, was the psychiatrist for the Huxtables, the fictional family on The Cosby Show. Poussant is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School.